On behalf of the Foundation for Sacred Arts, please join me in welcoming Dr. Peter Kraft.
I'm not an artist or an art teacher or an expert in any of the areas of art or sacred art. I'm a philosopher, an absent-minded professor, and my specialty is not even aesthetics, which is a subdivision of philosophy. So what right do I have to be talking to you here tonight? Exactly the same right that you have to be talking to me. And the most important part of our evening is going to be the question and answer session, the dialogue, where we share the floor. But in order to get there, we have to have a speech. The direct answer to what right I have to speak to you is I'm a human being. Every human being is an artist. What I'm going to say to you tonight may or may not be useful to you, but its usefulness is not going to come from my expertise. This is not a polished lecture. This is not publishable, deliberately designed that way, because when I listen to a lecture, first of all, I'm usually bored and can't wait to get to the Q&A. Secondly, I always pick out little parts of it that I find are useful, if any, and there are always little parts of it, not the whole thing. Sometimes I'll go to a lecture where the lecturer has thought everything through and it's a beautiful, rounded, finished work of art in itself, and it's wonderful to contemplate. And I say, how well he speaks, but I don't remember a thing he said. When Cicero addressed the Roman Senate, everyone marveled at how wonderfully he spoke, but they kept their seats. When Demosthenes addressed his troops in a much more barbaric way, their response was to jump into the air, clash their swords on their shields, and say, now let us march. So I hope I can be a little bit more like Demosthenes than Cicero. One of my favorite books is Pascal's Pensées, and that's partly because it exists in the form of little snippets. I pick out little snippets anyway, and I think you do too, so why not speak in snippets? So I will give you a deliberately unfinished, unpolished, not perfectly logically integrated series of 14 thoughts. Now, this is a little dangerous because Pascal was planning to take these pensées, there are about 1,000 of them, and integrate them into a polished book of apologetics, which would have spoiled it. So God, in his mercy, killed him before he could do it. I don't find that funny. If you know God at all, you know that he can be scary. Fortunately, he has a sense of humor as well as grace. The general vague order of my 14 thoughts will be from the general to the particular, from the abstract to the concrete, from the philosophical to the artistic, from beauty in general to beauty in the religious arts. And I know more about general stuff than about particular stuff because I'm an absent-minded professor with his head in the clouds. Well, the 14 points are going to concern the relation between beauty and, first of all, mystery. Secondly, universality. Thirdly, ecstasy. Fourth, power. Fifth, love. Sixth, sexuality. Seventh, sanctity. Eighth, Jesus Christ. Ninth, infinity. 10, the cosmos. 11, art. 12, liturgy. 13, music. And 14, a word that you probably never heard, orinda. It's an Iroquois word. And it labels rather than explains all the other mysteries. Let's start by trying to define the term beauty. When we do that, we find that it is not a problem that can be defined, but a mystery that can only be participated in. Gabriel Marcel, one of my favorite philosophers, makes that now famous distinction between problems and mysteries. He says most of the great questions, in fact, all of the great questions of philosophy, the only ones that are important, are mysteries like, why do people fall in love? Why are we evil? Why must we die? How are the soul and the body united? Why do we know there's a God, but we can't define him? None of those questions can be definitively, clearly answered by us in this life. In that sense, that popular sense, they're mysteries. But in another sense, Marcel says, they're mysteries because the reason we can't come to the end of them is that we are them. We live them. We participate in them. We can solve a problem like how many atoms are in the sun. It's difficult, but we can do it. We can't solve the problem of why we are so evil, why we are so insane as to prefer misery to joy, or why we fall in love. Oh, we can explain some of the biological factors, and we can predict to a certain extent that we're more likely to fall in love with a human being than with a goat, but unless we're a certain kind of human being. But we can't go very far there. Why? Because we don't fully know ourselves. We are the primary mystery because we are made in God's image, and God's name, his holy, eternal name, revealed once and only once to his chosen people. He revealed many relational names like Creator and Redeemer, but only once did he reveal his own essential nature to Moses in the burning bush, and the name is so holy that no Orthodox Jew will speak it, at least in Hebrew. And translated into English, it goes, I am, or I am who am. That I, that subject that can never become an object, is the essence of personhood and the reason for our mystery. We cannot objectify the self that's doing the objectifying. And whatever is an integral part of that self can also not wholly be objectified. And our sense of beauty and our love of beauty is an integral part of that self. So it is always an ongoing mystery. We can, however, though we can't define beauty, give certain attributes of it. And the classical answer to that question from Thomas Aquinas is that there are at least four attributes of beauty. He says, beauty consists in a certain clarity and proportion. Each of these is found in the reason, because both the light that makes beauty seen and the establishing of due proportion among things belong to reason. A corollary of this fact is that since the contemplative life consists in an act of the reason, there is beauty in that life by its very nature. Beauty is also in the moral virtues by participation, insofar as they participate in the order of reason, and especially in the virtue of temperance, which restrains the concupiscences which especially darken the light of reason. This is why the virtue of chastity, most of all, makes man apt for the contemplation of truth, since venereal pleasures, most of all, weigh the mind down. He also says that beauty and goodness in a thing are really identical, for they are based on the same thing, namely its form. And consequently, goodness is praised as beauty. But the concepts differ logically, for goodness properly relates to the appetite, goodness being what all things desire, and therefore it has an aspect of an end or a final cause, since the appetite is a kind of movement towards an end. But beauty relates more to the cognitive faculty, for beautiful things are those which please when seen. Now, the classic definition of beauty, then, by Aquinas, is beauty is id quod videtur placet, that which, when being seen, pleases. And the four attributes that please us in all things beautiful, says Aquinas, are the unity, the proportion, the harmony, and above all, the radiance of the form. This is the one that von Balthasar emphasizes the most. I can't claim to have understood von Balthasar, but I think understood that he is worth understanding, so I recommend giving him a try. It's a hard thing to define, and yet, to be very unsophisticated, we all know it when we see it. Truth and goodness are very easy to define. What is truth is one of the easiest questions in the world. We all know what truth is. Aristotle defines truth in a classic definition in which all the words are one-syllable words. When a man says of what is that it is, or of what is not that it is not, he speaks the truth. When he says of what is that it is not, or of what is not that it is, he does not speak the truth. Wonderful. It takes a genius to be that simple. Goodness is also easy to define. Aristotle does that on the very first page of his Ethics. The good is that at which all things aim. The good is the end. The good is the desirable. That's easy. But what's beauty? Beauty is something that, when it's seen, instantly and universally pleases the seer. Well, that's not quite a definition, because a definition has to narrow down the thing more than that does. And it also has to give the genus. And here our genus is simply a something or other. So it's not a definition. But it's helpful. Look for those four qualities. And I think you will find them in everything beautiful. And I think you will find their absence in everything ugly. My second point is that beauty is universal. Or, as the philosophers say, transcendental. Beauty is one of the qualities that every single thing that is real possesses. Everything that is real possesses oneness. Even a group is one group. And goodness, it's good for something. And truth, that is, it corresponds to God's mind, the ultimate standard of truth. And it's beautiful. There is beauty in everything, everywhere. In the dirty plastic bottle blowing in the wind in that one beautiful scene from that ugly movie, American Beauty. Beauty and truth are closely related. Beauty is a kind of truth because you see it. You see the radiant form, the inner light of it. Aquinas was so wonderfully, childishly simple as to say, this is why bright colors are beautiful. Now, he didn't mean that every artist ought to make as bright colors as possible and never use pastels, but he's probably remembering, when he was a little kid, the fascination for bright colors. Why did you stare into the fire for half an hour when you were three? Because the color is so bright and so penetrating. Why did you just stare at the sky when the sun was out, much more than when it was cloudy? Because that blue was so blue. So there's something in color itself, quite apart from what you do with it, that's very beautiful. That's the radiance of the form. Form doesn't just mean shape. It means essence or nature. Beauty is also, by nature, good. We're attracted to it. There's a magnetism. Every basic school of psychology, from Plato to Freud, just about everyone, has said that there are three essential powers of the human soul. One of them is the mind, or the intelligence, by which we know or try to know the truth. And another is the will, by which we try to attain or choose the good. And then there's a third one, the appreciative power, or the creativity, or the imagination, by which we are aware of the beautiful. Which is why when we write long epics with three protagonists rather than short stories with one, the three protagonists almost always correspond to these three distinctively human powers. In The Brothers Karamazov, probably the greatest novel ever written, the three brothers are Ivan, the intellectual, and Dmitri, the strong-willed brother, and Alyosha, who is the master of compassion and feeling. In The Lord of the Rings, greatest book of the 20th century, the three Christ figures who save Middle-earth are Gandalf, the prophet figure, and Aragorn, the king figure, and Frodo, the priest figure. In the Old Testament, prophet, priest, and king, the three divinely instituted offices corresponding to these three human powers. Even in the Gospels, Jesus picks out an inner circle, Peter, James, and John. And John is clearly the mystic and the intellectual. His gospel is far more philosophical than any of the others. And Peter is the rock, the leader, the Captain Kirk, who takes the starship soul to heaven. And James is the practical moralist. And, of course, in Star Trek, you have Captain Kirk and Mr. Spock and Bones McCoy. That's the most philosophical of all TV shows. So beauty is equally distinctive, equally human. Animals only approach it. Animals don't have much of a sense of beauty. Animals will mess things up and not understand what they're doing. Just as animals don't have a moral conscience, and animals don't have abstract reasoning. They have something like all three. They have cleverness. They have instinctive intelligence, sometimes cleverer than we are. And they certainly have desires They want certain things, but they can't make any choices. They don't understand values or principles. And they have something like a sense of appropriateness. A dog will never pee in his own cage, which is why you can train dogs, but he'll pee far away. Well, that's not high aesthetics, but it's something. In fact, it's greater than some people's aesthetics, like Andre Serrano. My third point, which is a little easier, notice I haven't successfully come to the end of any point yet. My third point, which is a little easier to answer, is what is our experience of beauty? Not so much what is beauty, but what happens in us when we experience beauty. And one of my favorite sources for this is one of the Enneads by Plotinus, the great Greek mystical philosopher, all of whose works were not known to the Middle Ages except this one treatise, the one on beauty. And it's his most beautiful one. He says, beauty is something that is detected at a first glance. Something that the soul, remembering, names, recognizes. Notice he doesn't just say cognizes, recognizes. There's something akin. Oh, yes, that's it. The aha experience. What is there in the soul? What is that beauty detector, that aesthetic Geiger counter that buzzes when we see something beautiful? It's there. The soul gives welcome to it and, in a way, fuses with it. When you see something beautiful, your soul becomes more beautiful. It rubs off somehow. When the soul falls in with ugliness, it shrinks back, repulses it as disagreeable and alien. We therefore suggest that the soul, being what it is, and related to the reality above it, is delighted when it sees any signs of its kinship with that reality. Now, Plotinus is not a Christian, but Christians, especially Christian mystics, took this over and said, well, he's onto something here, because the reality that is above the soul is God, and God is beautiful, and the kinship is that we are made in God's image. And therefore, when we see anything that resembles God, we love it. We're delighted, because that shows us who we are. That shows us where we come from and where we're destined for. He goes on to say, that is why in the realm of sound, I'll say something more specifically about music later, as I think most powerful of all the arts, that is why in the realm of sound, unheard harmonies create harmonies we hear. What a fascinating suggestion. Seeing this, one undergoes a joy, a wonder, and a distress. Notice he puts together joy and distress. Any one of those two is inadequate to explain or expound the experience of beauty. Beauty isn't just satisfaction. You don't just rest in it. It's not just distress. It's not just painful. It's a joyful pain. It breaks your heart. What's the highest compliment anybody can ever give to an artist? You broke my heart. A joy, a wonder, and a distress more deep than any other, because here one touches truth. Such emotions all beauty induce, an astonishment, a delicious wonderment, a longing, a love, a trembling that is all delight. All perceive it. Not all are stung sharply by it. Only those whom we call lovers ever are. I'll suggest later that when we apply these principles to Christ, though Plotinus was not a Christian, there are profound psychology of the beauty of Jesus. Everybody who ever met Jesus wondered at him. I just published a book a couple months ago called Jesus Shock, which was about that elementary wonder. Nobody was ever bored with Jesus. And nobody ever simply liked him. And nobody ever simply hated him. Everybody felt an ambivalence. On the one hand, a profound attraction. On the other hand, not a repulsion, but a shrinking back. Well, those are just suggestions. But what Plotinus is talking about here is a kind of literal ecstasy. where the soul throws off its clothes and escapes like a snake shedding its skin, stands outside of its skin. Ecstasy literally means standing outside yourself, something like an out-of-body experience. When you have a deep love and appreciation of deep beauty, you have an out-of-body experience. Out-of-body experiences are not nearly as rare as most people think. They're not just a prerogative of mystics or people who have near-death experiences. Whenever you forget yourself entirely, you're having an out-of-body experience. Say you're reading a book. Say you're reading The Lord of the Rings. Somebody comes to you and says, who are you? Well, I'm Peter Kraft. Where are you? In Boston. What are you doing reading The Lord of the Rings? Why? Because I have to teach it tomorrow. That's not an out-of-body experience. But the first time I ever read The Lord of the Rings, if somebody had come to me in the middle of it and asked me, who are you? I would have said, I'm Frodo Baggins. What are you doing? I'm carrying the ring to Mordor, I hope. Where are you? I'm on Weathertop, being assailed by the Black Riders. When is it? Sometime in the second age of Middle Earth. See, I'm not in my seat. And that's relatively easy. That's what art does. It helps us to escape ourselves. It gives us something like an out-of-body experience. All right, so much about point three, our experience of beauty. Another mysterious question, the power of beauty over us. Why does it have such a power to take us out of our skins? We all know it does, but why? Suppose you have to choose between a number of different parishes, and one of them has truth, true doctrine is proclaimed there, and goodness, good morality, and there's good people, but no beauty. It's boring, it's dull, it's ugly. You don't want to worship there. No temptation to go there. On the other hand, take two other parishes, one of which has beauty and goodness, but lacks truth. They preach heresy, but they're good people, and the service is beautiful. You're tempted to go there. Another place has true doctrine and a beautiful liturgy, but the pastor's a hypocrite and the people are libertines, and yeah, but you're tempted to go there. Beauty is a more powerful, attractive feature than anything else, at least at first. Even more than truth and goodness. Maybe it shouldn't be, but it is. I don't know whether it should be or not, but it isn't. If beauty didn't move us more than goodness, temptation would be impossible. Because temptation always uses the attractiveness or apparent beauty of something that's evil to lure us to prefer it to what is good. The devil's a fisherman, and he has to bait his hook with a worm. No fish would swallow a hook, but if there's a nice, fat, wiggly worm, it might, and we're stupid fish. We observe very commonly that men are more attracted to beauty than to goodness in their choice of women and lifestyles and often cars. Now, whether or not this applies equally to women must be decided by a woman and not a man. I don't know. Maybe they have their own foolishness. There are far more poems in praise of beauty than in praise of truth. Now, I don't think poems are a reliable index of objective truth, but I think they are a reliable index of what moves the human heart and human love. The beauty of a place will sell it to travel agents. The beauty of a person will sell that person to other people. Thus, we see that people prefer to live in more expensive and harsher places, such as the stormy seashore or the high and dangerous mountains, rather than in dull and more economically efficient places. And we see that people are attracted to interesting people. And men are more attractive to women who are beautiful in face and figure than those who are better for them in every other way. And this is also true of spiritual beauty. Because nothing is more attractive and irresistible than a saint. This is how the Christian religion won the world. Not through its mysterious and apparently irrational theology, or its difficult and uncompromising and unflattering and inconvenient morality, but by the beauty of its saints. The hard-nosed Romans said, Look at those guys. They're going to the mouths of the lions with smiles and hymns on their lips. They're either crazy or they're into something that's so beautiful that we don't understand it. Beauty has such power over us that we can't be happy without it. Well, I think the secret of this power, and that's my next point, is that beauty always has to do with love. Beauty is the object of our love, and love moves us more than anything else. Love is our gravity. One of my favorite sentences in Christian philosophy is Augustine's, "Amor meus pondus meum." My love is my gravity, my weight, my destiny. It pulls me. It's the power that pulls me out of myself. It's the central power of the soul. And the satisfaction of love is the primary cause of human happiness. And beauty is one of the main things we love. The first book Augustine ever wrote was about beauty. It's lost, and in the Confessions he mentions it, and he shows how much of a saint he is because he's the most famous writer in the world, and here's his first book, which is the closest to his heart, and he's lost it, and he doesn't complain. He doesn't even kvetch. He just says, okay, I've lost it. Do we love anything save what is beautiful? What then is beautiful, and what is beauty? What is it that allures us and delights us in the things we love? I composed certain books about this, called On the Beautiful and the Fitting. They were two books or three, I fancy. You know, O Lord, for I do not remember. I no longer have them. Somehow or other, they've been lost. Well, let's go on to something else now. That's sanctity. Plato explains the connection between beauty and love beautifully in the Symposium. We never love the ugly, we always love the beautiful. And he says this is because unconsciously what we love is immortality. Immortality? You mean heaven, life after death? No, just, well, let me read you his words. The desire for beauty is a desire to breed in beauty, both in body and in soul. All men and women are pregnant, both in body and in soul. But we cannot beget in an ugly thing, but only in a beautiful thing, whether in body or in soul. This is why we love beauty, because we want to beget, we want to create. None of this is proved, and all of this is unconscious rather than conscious. So if you're the kind of philosopher who wants logical proof of everything, you're going to be disappointed tonight. But if you're the kind of little kid who just wants to discover some things, gee, look at that, I can give you some fingers and point to you. Obviously, I'm going to say something about the connection between beauty and God. And obviously, I'm going to say all beauty comes from God and leads to God, and therefore beauty is an essential aspect of religion. And this is why religion is mankind's greatest passion. Subtract religion from the history of the world, and very little is left. And the little that is left can hardly ever be explained. There's only one other passion that rivals religion in human history. That's sex. Those are the two subjects of most jokes. Those are the two things that embarrass the most people. That are the two things that are not to be mentioned at polite cocktail parties. Why? Because those are the two greatest beauties. And they are, in different ways, both ecstasies. They both bring you out of yourself into the other. This is the deepest reason, I think, why in Jewish and Christian and Muslim scriptures, God is always he and never she. Because our relationship with God is always, in a sense, spiritually sexual. It's a relationship with the other. A man is other than a woman and comes into a woman from without, not only when he impregnates her, but even when he first meets her. What's that? That's Mars. I'm Venus. You're different. That's the whole fascination of it. Well, that's the God of the Bible. He's other. He's transcendent. He comes into us from without. That's not the God of polytheism, of paganism. Those gods are just like us, big brothers. It's certainly not the God of pantheism. The God of pantheism is just everything in general and nothing in particular. But this is the God who fascinates because he's other, and he comes to us with a love proposal. He's our Romeo and we're Juliet. To call God he and never she, which the Hebrew and Christian and Muslim scriptures always do, is not male chauvinism. If anything, it's female chauvinism. Because the human soul is always feminine in relation to God's wooing. God always has the initiative. But there's a deep connection between sex and religion. Both of them bring us out of ourself to the other. And John Paul II, in his Theology of the Body, has a beautiful answer to the question, why be a Catholic priest if you can't have sex and you can't have a family and you can't have a woman? Don't you have to sublimate it and simply sacrifice it? And his answer is, no, you bypass one form of it to go to the greatest form of it. The relationship with God, which is more complete and more total, is a sort of supersexual relationship. So you don't need the lower one. As you probably all know, I hope you've all made at least some discoveries of this great new theological breakthrough, the theology of the body, which is, I think, the church's definitive answer to the most important revolution of modern times, the sexual revolution. At the heart of this is the connection between sex and religion, because sex is an icon of the Trinity itself. The Trinity is love. God is love. God can't be love without being a Trinity. If God's only one person, he can be a lover, but he can't be love itself. And in the Trinity, each person is ecstatic. The Father forgets himself and gives himself totally to the Son. The Son forgets himself and gives himself totally to the Father. We know that because he says so. He says, I came into the world not to do my own will, but the will of the Father. Jesus Christ was the greatest conformist who ever lived. And that made him the most creative and interesting person who ever lived. And then the Spirit is their love child, their eternal love child, who proceeds from the love between them and gives the love back. That's why sex is so fascinating. Now, even long before the theology of the body, great spiritual writers recognized some such connection. For instance, Thomas Aquinas in the Summa says, no man can live without joy. That is why anyone deprived of spiritual joy must go over to carnal pleasures. When you read a sentence like that, you say, duh, yeah. Point number 8. The most beautiful thing any of us have ever seen in this world is Jesus Christ. No comparison. The supreme object of beauty, the supreme example of beauty, is Christ. I'm looking for a quotation by the Pope. Give me a minute. I will find it. Here we are. Being overcome by the beauty of Christ is a more real, more profound knowledge than mere rational deduction. This by one of the greatest philosophers in the world, Joseph Ratzinger. But this truth has not yet found its proper echo in the life of the church. And this is not only or principally a problem for theology. Rather, it is a problem for pastoral ministry, whose mission is to get people to encounter the beauty of the faith. Where do they encounter that? Primarily in Christ himself. Probably the most moving paragraph in the most moving Christian book of all time, the Confessions of Augustine, towards the end, after the story is about over, is, late have I loved thee, O beauty, so ancient and so new. Late have I loved thee. And look at the passion in the next couple of sentences. For behold, thou wert within me and I outside. And I sought thee outside, and in my unloveliness fell upon those lovely things that thou hast made. Thou wert with me, and I was not with thee. I was kept from thee by those things, yet had they not been in thee, they would not have been at all. Now, watch the violence of the imagery. Thou didst call and cry to me, and burst open my deafness. Thou didst send forth thy beams, and shine upon me, and chase away my blindness. Thou didst breathe fragrance upon me, and I drew in my breath, and do now pant for thee. I tasted thee, and now hunger and thirst for thee. Thou didst touch me, and I have burned for thy peace. Anyone who could write like that is either an artist or a saint or both. A saint is a little Christ. The connection between the beauty of the saints and the beauty of Christ is the connection between the original and the image, of course. And one of the most powerful ways to become a saint is simply to see the beauty of God. In heaven, we'll all be saints. People often ask the question, will we be able to sin in heaven? And the answer is obviously no. And then their next question is, oh, then God must take away our free will. No. Well, if we have free will, we'll be able to sin, because free will is always a choice. And the answer is yes. Well, then why won't we? And the answer is the beauty of God. In the beatific vision, we will see the beauty of God so clearly, so overwhelmingly, that it will be impossible to sin. Why does anybody sin? Why does a thief steal money? Because he sees that money can buy attractive things. The dirty pieces of paper aren't attractive, although gold might be, but the dirty pieces of paper can buy things that satisfy his desires and are attractive to him. He wouldn't steal cockroaches. He'd steal gold. But in heaven, we'll see that sin is like a cockroach, because we'll see that God is the real gold. So the vision of the beauty of God makes it impossible to sin. Well, the more we can get that here, the more close to sanctity we are. Religious art isn't just kicks. It's not just aesthetics. It's a powerful aid to attain the ultimate meaning of human life, to be a saint. I love that line of Léon Bloch, 19th century French Catholic writer, in a lot of his plays. In the end, there is only one tragedy, not to have been a saint. And beauty is a very powerful aid to that. So the more you see the beauty of God, the more you love him. Well, how do you see the beauty of God? How do you open your eyes? Well, unfortunately, the only way to open the eyes is love. So you can only see God when you love him, and you can only love him when you see him. So where do you start? Well, with both, but they reinforce each other. It's like the relation between the mind and the senses. If you have no sense experience, you have no information, you have an empty mind. And if you have no principles and no concepts, you don't understand your sense experience. So the more sense knowledge you have, the more conceptual knowledge you have. And the more conceptual knowledge you have, the more clear your sense knowledge is. So each feeds the other. And where do you start? Both at the same time. It's not like a chicken and egg. They start simultaneously. So this loving God and seeing the beauty of God start simultaneously and reinforce each other, and each is the most powerful means to the other. I know of no more effective way of loving God than seeing his beauty, and I know of no other way of seeing his beauty than to love him. And that's true of human beings too. That's the Romeo and Juliet relationship. Why did Dante perceive the beauty of Beatrice when nobody else in the world did? She was a plain Jane to everybody else, because he loved her. Why did he love her? Because he suddenly, by divine grace, had this vision of her beauty. Same with God. I was talking to some priests at a monastery in Connecticut some years ago, and I thought they were very wise and holy, and I wished they would lecture to me instead of me to them, but I did my best, and we had a lot of questions afterwards, and they waited until the end with this question. They said, Professor Graves, I'd like to ask you one last question. If you could ask God for one gift for all of us in this community, and you were infallibly assured that God would give it to us, what gift would you ask for? I said, that's a profound question. So I couldn't hesitate. I just blurted out, I would ask that God make every single one of you fall totally in love with Jesus Christ for the rest of your life. At that point, they all gently laughed. I knew they were holy, so they weren't laughing at me. And the abbot said, I'm sorry, we're not laughing at you, but the reason we're laughing is Mother Teresa was here 30 days ago, and we asked her that question, and she gave exactly the same answer word for word. I felt good. Sometimes you get it right. Is Christ beautiful because he's divine or because he's human? Obviously both. He's perfect God and perfect man, and beauty comes from perfection. It's fairly easy to see, for anybody to see, why Christ is beautiful as man. Even non-Christians see that. You have to be very wicked not to see that. You have to be a Nietzsche not to see that. But how can God be beautiful? How can the God of the Bible be beautiful? Because he's infinite. He's not a pagan god. Zeus is beautiful. Apollo is beautiful. Hercules is beautiful. He looks like Superman. Aphrodite is beautiful. She looks like, I don't know, some movie actress. But how can the infinite being be beautiful? Doesn't beauty have to have finite form? To ask that question is to show that you misunderstand what is meant by God's infinity, and we almost always do. We think that infinity means everything in general and therefore nothing in particular. It doesn't. The God of the Bible has a personality, a character, just as you or I do. He is wise and not foolish. He is righteous, not unrighteous or indifferent. He is alive, not dead. He's a lover, not a hater or indifferent. He's big on justice. He's always ready with his mercy. He's got a character, a personality. And only in relationship with him can you understand that personality. Philosophers never came up with that idea, that God has a personality. But those who pray to him do. One moment of blurred contrition or weak aspiration and adoration can tell you more about the nature of God than reading volumes of speculative theology. But if God has a particular character, how is he infinite? Well, he's infinitely wise. He's infinitely loving. He's infinitely just. He's infinitely everything that he is. But he's this and not that. And if you have to choose between denying that God's attributes are infinite, but saying that he has them, and being a sort of a super pagan, and saying that God is sort of a superhuman being, but at least he's somebody with a distinctive personality, but maybe he's not infinite, maybe he's not eternal, maybe he's not infinitely powerful. Well, that's a heresy, but that's heresy A. Heresy B, God is absolutely perfect, infinite in every way, but he doesn't have any personality, and I can't really meet him, so there's no use in praying to him. That's a far worse heresy. I remember my son, when he was about, maybe 8, 10 years old, he wanted very much a new bicycle, very expensive bicycle for Christmas. He didn't know whether he was going to get it or not. So we were talking about God, and he said, is it okay if I pray to God for the bicycle? He says, I know you're Santa Claus, and you give it to me, but I hope God will make you give it to me. So he says, do you think it's right if I ask God to get in your head and make you give me the bike? So I said, certainly. Why not? And he said, well, wait a minute. You said, or my religion teacher said, that God is unchangeable and he's eternal. And you can't change him. You can't push him around. So if God can't be changed, I can't change his mind. So why should I bother praying to him? I said, this kid's going to be a theologian. But he's not. He's a pilot, but he's a good Catholic. So I had a choice then of being an accurate theologian and answering his question as a philosophy professor and trying to keep both halves of the paradox in place. Yes, he's eternal, but on the other hand, you can pray to him. And I knew he wouldn't have understood that. I don't even fully understand that. Or compromising a little bit and ministering to his immediate need. So I said to him, you think you can change my mind? He said, yeah. He said, well, Jesus called God his father, so that's the closest we can come to understanding God, so I think maybe you can change God's mind too, so keep praying. Oh, okay, he said. Big relief. Big sigh of relief. Now, maybe some theologians would call that heresy, but I think that was necessary. Because to know God as a person, personally, in a relationship, is much more precious than having accurate ideas about him. Yeah, the ideas are important. They're like a roadmap. But what's more important, the map or the car? So my point is that God is beautiful even though he's infinite because infinity isn't the infinity of the pantheistic blob God. It's the infinity of a perfect personality, And how do you know the Father? Don't, please, don't ever try to go beyond Jesus and know the Father as some sort of thing beyond Jesus. Because the Bible clearly says that he who has seen me has seen the Father. That's all there is. There ain't no more. Read Colossians 1. The Father gives absolutely everything to the Son. So if you want to know who God is, Jesus, that's it. The only difference between the Father and the Son is that the Son comes from the Father. They're different persons, but their attributes are the same. All right, enough about beauty in general. What does this have to do with the beauty of religious art? I've made 9 points so far. I've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 5 to go. Point 10, art is everywhere. In fact, everything is religious art because God created the universe. The universe is the greatest work of art that exists. God is not a work of art. Art is something that's made. God is not made. But everything else is made by God. Therefore, the universe is the greatest of all works of art. So science and art almost coincide. Our science is reading God's art from the underside. So don't think of religious art as some narrow specialty. Think of it as cosmic, or at least modeled on the cosmos. Next question, question 11. Where is the beauty in a work of art, whether it's religious art or non-religious art, if there is such a thing? Maybe deep down all art is religious, at least unconsciously, but that's another question. Where is the beauty? Well, first of all, obviously, it's in the work of art. It has to be beautiful. It has to have these qualities of form and proportion and order and harmony and whatnot. But it's also in the subject. The person who makes it has to have something beautiful in the idea, according to which it's made, which expresses itself in the opus, the making. And the one who views it or uses it or hears it also has something beautiful in his soul at the moment of viewing it or hearing it. So it's in the person, the subject, the experiencer. We went into that in quoting Plotinus about this experience of wonder and ecstasy. So it's in the experience, in the relationship, as well as in the work. But there's a third place that beauty is, and that's the most powerful and mysterious of all. It's somewhere else, because I think all art is like a finger. However beautiful it is, it always points beyond itself. However beautiful a perfume is, it always comes from a woman. However beautiful the smell of apple pie is, it always comes from an apple pie. So art is like God's perfume or God's apple pie. And it points back to God. It's a shadow. It's a sign. Great art is not a thing in the world merely. It's a hole in the world. For instance, to Dante, Beatrice was a great work of art because when he looked at Beatrice, he didn't see simply a woman with perfect figure and face. He saw a moon which reflected the light of the sun, which was God. So Dante said things about Beatrice which, taken literally, are pagan and idolatrous. She's a goddess. She's not just human. There's something eternal about Beatrice. Why? Well, she's a mirror, and the eternal light is reflected off that mirror, and he's seeing not just Beatrice the human being, but Beatrice the icon. Protestants think that Catholics worship images, especially icons. They don't understand that icons are signs. You see through them. Mary is the primary icon, and what's her primary role? Show unto us the blessed fruit of thy womb, Jesus. She's always pointing to Jesus, and an icon is like that. It's a sign. I have two dogs, rather had two dogs. One died a month ago. One was a yellow lab who was very bright, and one is a basset hound who's still alive. He's very stupid. And I could train the yellow lab much more easily than the basset hound, although I don't like to train animals. I like to let them be animals. But when I point to something, the yellow lab would follow my finger. The basset hound could never learn to do that. He'd always come up and sniff my finger. Here are two people looking at an icon. One just looks at it, and one looks through it. The one who looks through it is the yellow lab. The one who looks at it is the basset hound. The medievals had an elaborate philosophy of that. They said, Since God designed and created the universe, everything that exists is not only a thing, but it's also a sign. A sign of God. They said God wrote two books. First nature, then scripture. They're both books. And therefore, you have to learn to read the books. And they read the book of nature in a very allegorical and symbolic way. The lion symbolizes the great lion of Judah, and the rose is the mystical rose, and they had everything in a beautifully arranged hierarchy. And of course, it was a little artificial, but it was beautiful. Because it was a guess at the mind of God. It was a finger pointing upwards. Point 12, the primary work of religious art is, of course, the work that is the liturgy. The very word liturgy means public work. Because the liturgy is Jesus Christ himself operating, acting. He, not the priest, transubstantiates. He incarnates himself again. The reason why those Gothic cathedrals were the greatest architectural miracles in history, vastly surpassing the technological capabilities of such a primitive age as the early Middle Ages. The reason they existed is because Jesus Christ was not only in them, and we wanted to honor him with maximum honor, so we had to build the most beautiful buildings ever built because he was there, but also he was inspiring them. He was in the builders. There's a story that the emperor of Russia wanted to know whether he should convert to Catholic Christianity, Eastern Orthodox Christianity, or I think it was Judaism. It was a third option. So he invited priests from all three, clergy from all three religions to come and talk, and he was not convinced by the talk. And then he attended each of the liturgies. And when he attended the Eastern Orthodox liturgy, he said, "My soul went to heaven. Russia will be Orthodox." The power of the liturgy is, as you might expect, an irresistible power. This is why liturgical norms are so important and why liturgical defamation is so destructive. It's not just a work of art that we're doing. It's God's primary work of art. The liturgy includes a little bit of everything, everything human. All the arts participate in it, including architecture. I mentioned the Gothic cathedrals, which I often marvel at. Let me tell you two things about Gothic cathedrals. I'd never been in one until I was about 10 years old, and I was born and brought up as a Calvinist. And Calvinist churches are very plain and puritanical and dull. Calvinists are good and nice people, like Mormons. Their theology is more orthodox, but they're nice, dull people usually. And their churches are nice, dull churches. And I went to St. Patrick's Cathedral, lived in New Jersey, visited in New York City, and I was awestruck. And I remember turning to my father, who was an elder in the church, and a good man, a good theologian, and I really wanted to know. I said, Dad, we're in a Catholic church, right?
Right.
Well, the Catholics are wrong, aren't they? Oh, yes, they're very, very wrong, yes. Well, how come their churches are so much more beautiful than ours? And for the first time in my life, I asked my father a question he simply couldn't answer. He was confused. So that planted the first seed of doubt in my mind. Maybe there's something more than Calvinism. Sermons in stone. I have a fantasy about Gothic cathedrals. It's a kind of a waking dream. It's not literally a dream or a vision, but it's a recurring thought. I see them as rocket ships. The flying buttresses look like the fins of rockets. And when I see a close-up picture of the Cathedral of Notre Dame in Paris, I'm amazed that it's still there. Why hasn't it taken it off from its launching pad? If it suddenly zoomed off, I'd be less surprised at the fact that it's still there. It's a miracle. Stone is a very heavy thing. You don't expect stone to become as light as an angel, but that's what happened there. That was a miracle. The only other art besides liturgy and architecture. I think architecture, by the way, is a crucial art because it bridges culture and civilization. It bridges the spiritual and the material, probably better than any other art does. It has a foot firmly in both worlds. But I think to most people, certainly to me, the most powerful art of all is music. Plato, when he writes The Republic, spends one paragraph on economics. He spends 40 pages on music. The Republic is about, among other things, the ideal state. And the details are silly. This class should be allowed to listen to this kind of music, and that class should be allowed to listen to that kind of music, and the state should censor music, and I don't buy all that. But I do buy Plato's immense attention to music. One of his contemporaries, a wise man called Damon of Athens, wrote, "Let me write the songs of a nation, and I care not who writes its laws." There was a Chinese emperor who, according to legend, which may or may not be true, ran China by music for about 40 years. He was very sensitive to music, and he didn't have many soldiers, and he had to rule the whole empire of China, which was immense, and there was war breaking out all over the place, civil wars. So he hit upon this expedient. He disguised himself as a peasant and visited each of his 25 or 50 major cities once a year, walking as a disguised peasant through the streets and listening to the music that the people sang and played. And if the music was in harmony with the Tao, the way of the universe, the way of nature, and the way of sanctity in a human life, he would let it alone. But if the music was disharmonious and expressed antagonism to the Tao, and he had a sensitivity for that, he would then go back to his capital and send soldiers to that city, who then would be on hand when the revolt broke out months later. And it worked. Confucius, the most practical social reformer in the history of the world, who held China together for over 2,000 years, Confucius was so overcome by music once that for 2 days he could not speak or eat. The Greeks questioned everything, especially their gods, at least in the age of the philosophers. They never questioned 9 of their gods, the muses. The most skeptical Greeks said, well, we have to admit that music has to come from a divine source. Nobody, until Aristotle, ever had anything other than the divine inspiration theory of the origin of music in Greek thought. Aristotle was the first one to say it's a rational human craft. Maybe he had a tin ear. But the Greek music is incredibly simple. They had nothing more than lutes and panpipes, and no polyphony, and no harmony, and no a cappella choruses, and no oratorios, and very simple music. And yet they were so moved by it that they said, this has to come from the gods. Where else could it possibly come from? I want to recommend a couple of things. One of them is a very funny book by Thomas Day entitled Why Catholics Can't Sing. One of the reasons I pray every day for reunion between the churches is I'm very selfish. I want all the beauty of a Byzantine liturgy, and I want all the greatness of the old Protestant hymns, and I don't want to sing Marty Haugen or praise choruses. Thank you. I don't want to loudly and comfortably say, announce to the world that I'm on eagle's wings. I want to let all mortal flesh keep silence. But music has uniquely the power to give us this experience that Plotinus describes as astonishment, a self-forgetfulness, an ecstasy, an out-of-body experience. I still remember the first time in my life I ever heard a Beethoven symphony. I grew up musically deprived. I had never heard Beethoven. I'd heard about him, but I had never heard him. So, I don't know, 13 years old, 15 years old, whatever, I got the Ninth Symphony and put it on my old Victrola, 33 RPM, and sat alone in a room and listened to the whole thing in absolute, total, rapt fascination. And when the choral ode began, I remember still vividly the feeling of absolute terror, because I thought, I will never get back into my body. I have become the music. And then, of course, I got back into my body, and I'm here. Well, that's what music can do. Take you out of your body. That's what all beauty can do. Beauty isn't, I think, merely what Aquinas describes it as. That's a little too classical. That's a little too limited. I'm not sure that Aquinas' definition would explain the Gothic cathedrals, the gargoyles especially, the irregularities. It wouldn't explain the preference for, let's say, Victorian architecture over classical architecture. It's a little too narrow. But what all beauty has, and here's my last point, is a very mysterious power, which I love an Iroquois word for. The word is orenda. My son-in-law is part Iroquois and part Mohawk and part Irish. quite a combination. I was talking to him once about this mysterious power in nature. Why in the world do we both love forests so much? We can't live there. We're not monkeys. We don't live in trees. And we cut trees down and change them into boards so that we can build houses and live in. And yet we're much happier out in the trees than in the houses. And why do we love the sea? We're not fish. We can't live in the sea. And yet, having ADD, I hardly ever finish a book, and I never finish watching a TV show. I get bored very easily. And yet I can sit for hours on my favorite rock and watch waves. Why? And why are the stars so fascinating? Why can you just lie on your back at night and look there and have a religious experience? Why is it very easy to pray under the stars? Ralph Waldo Emerson wrote, "If the stars should appear only one night in 1,000 years, how we then should appreciate that vision of heaven that had been shown." Well, my son-in-law explained that the Iroquois say that when God created the world, he put a certain kind of spiritual electricity in special things, like forests and seas and the stars. And that's orenda. And he put a hunger for that in us. So it's like Romeo meets Juliet. We're destined for it. That's, I think, one of the deepest reasons for the resurrection of the body. Not just for the body, but for the new earth. Heaven is going to be very earthy. According to the Bible, there's a new heavens and a new earth. The resurrection of the body is not just for some ethereal thing. We're not going to float in space. Why would we need a body for that? And the world we inhabit is not just going to be a mineral world like the moon. It's not going to be dead. It's going to be full of life. Plant life and even animal life wouldn't be full if it weren't. So the orenda in heaven is going to be the supreme electricity of beauty that will make us saints. And the fundamental reason why sacred art is important on earth is that it's a reflection of that and a kind of missionary of that. It's heaven's missionary to draw you there. So please support the foundation. They're doing a terribly important work. Now comes the time for questions. Now's the interesting time. By the way, what we're about to do is also a beautiful thing, although I've never heard anybody say this. To ask a question, that is something distinctly human. Questions don't just happen like rainstorms. You don't just bump into them like curbs. You make them, you create them. They're expressions of a demand to know, a love of truth, and that's beautiful. And only human beings can ask questions. Not animals, not God.
Thank you for your talk. To stop the problem of the vast background at Santa Claus, did you require something like
that? Yep. I'll tell you another Christmas story. When I was, 12 years old, I lusted after an expensive Lionel electric train. And I kept pestering my father for it, and we weren't that rich, and I didn't know whether he had the money to buy it. So he sat me down a couple days before Christmas, and he said, "Son, you know what Christmas is all about?" I said, "Okay, my mind. He's giving me a little religion lesson. I better behave so I get the train." I said, "I think so." He said, "Tell me what Christmas is all about." I said, "Well, it's about Jesus' birth. And why do we give each other gifts on Christmas?" I said, to show that we love each other. And why do we do that at Christmas? Well, God gave us Jesus because he loves us. Good, you understand the meaning of Christmas. Now, God's very rich, and he can afford to give everything, even his son. But we're not that rich, and we can't always afford the expensive Christmas presents that we'd like to buy. So if I can't afford this train that I know you want, do you still know that I love you? I said, uh-oh, what's the right answer? What's going to get me the train? If I say no, can I force him to get me the train to prove that, nah, wait a minute. If I say yes, and I was very confused, and I said, my father's smarter than I am. I'm not going to win this one. I got to be honest. So I said, of course, Dad, I know you love me. Okay, that's the only thing that matters. Remember that. He went away, and I said, darn it, I'm not going to get the train. Well, I got the train. But the train is rusting in my attic. But the lesson is not. Yeah. I will answer that question very simply. Yes.
If when you were speaking earlier about being in heaven and seeing beauty, having beatific vision, if Lucifer was a seraphim and had the beatific vision, how did he fall?
Oh, boy. James Collins, a Jesuit at St. Louis University about 50 years ago, wrote a 700-page book about that called The Sin of the First Angel. I tried reading it, and I gave up after page 50. So my simplest answer to that question is, it's a mystery. We don't know. God hasn't told us much about the consciousness of angels. But then I say, well, wait a minute. Maybe we can scratch a little bit off the surface. And theologians have done that. They said, there's only one sin that could explain Lucifer's rebellion, assuming that he had the beatific vision. Probably he didn't. I mean, the standard theological line is God tested the angels, and they were not created in the beatific vision. They were created in darkness, and God tested their faith. Do you trust me? So angels, too, need faith, or needed it at that moment. And some said yes, and some said no, and Satan led the ones who said no. But other theologians say that all angels always have the beatific vision, or the devils even had it, but left it. How is that possible? Well, the only possible thing that could motivate that is pride. He's giving me the vision, and I'm receiving it, so I'm dependent on him. I'm number two. I don't want to be number two. I want to be number one. Is that possible? Yes. Intelligent people can be proud. Satan is more intelligent than any human being. Well, look at human beings. Are intelligent people less proud than simpler people? No. But he'd have to be insane to leave the beatific vision. Yes, he is insane. So are we whenever we sin. That's the best I can do. But we shouldn't think too much about that. Don't get obsessed with the devil. Most people today think too little about him. It's also possible to think too much about him.
Hi, the Pope in some of his writings talks about the paradoxical beauty of the cross.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering if you could explore that, and also you made some interesting comments when you're talking about the liturgy and the importance of, you know, not having arbitrary deformations of it. So maybe you could sort of talk a little bit.
The liturgy should be like the cross. It should show and manifest the beauty of the cross. And we all intuitively understand that beauty. That's why I think more people wept at the Passion of the Christ than any other movie. I'm a movie buff, and I never saw an audience act like the secular audience in Boston acted when they saw that. Stunned silence, and they all sat in their seats for a few minutes afterwards. And there was copious weeping throughout the movie. Especially at that line where he is the most bloodied, and amazingly, he's still alive, and he goes on and on, and he's carrying his cross up the way of the cross, and his mother is doing what she can, and she says to him something like, "Why do you have to do this?" And he turns to her, he's hugging the cross, embracing it as if it were a woman, and he says, "See, Mother, I make all things new." What a beautiful line. Why is that beautiful? Because it's supreme love. Love is the most beautiful thing in the world. But it's not just a love to contemplate. It's a love of you. That movie's an icon. Jesus Christ addresses you in that movie. There's no proscenium arch. You're not in a theater. You're on the stage. You're there. You can't avoid him. That's what makes that movie so powerfully beautiful. But yeah, the cross itself is not beautiful. It's ugly. But the embracing of that ugliness by supreme love is supremely beautiful. Yes?
I wonder if you might be able to help me understand why popular music is popular.
It's a mystery.
Why do people like Iman?
Well, I understand. Because he makes them feel good, and he puts fewer demands on them. I understand why people prefer the Beatles to Beethoven. Sometimes I do. We need to relax sometimes. I don't understand why anybody prefers Michael Jackson. But then, there's no accounting for taste. In my own realm, words and writing, the mystery is even greater. I honestly do not understand how anybody with any grain of intelligence at all can read Frank Peretti or Tim LaHaye. Those novels are astonishingly bad. I mean, Dan Brown's an idiot, but he's a good writer. I understand how you could be carried along, but they're not even good writers, yet they sell millions and millions of copies. I don't understand that. So, I haven't answered your question, sorry. I guess some people don't like beautiful words. There's one writer that I think is wonderful and beautiful, but I've never been able to successfully teach, G.K. Chesterton. Because many students say, "I don't like him. He plays with words. He throws words at me. He makes me ashamed that I can't do paradoxes like him." Well, you shouldn't be ashamed. You should just revel in it. "Well, I can't. He embarrasses me." I don't know. I don't know. That's a very important philosophical question, and that's a scholarly question that I suppose I could make an attempt to answer, but it wouldn't be very good. There's two answers. There's two kinds of answer to that question. There's Thomas Aquinas' kind of answer. He pointed to four criteria: unity, proportion, harmony, and radiant form. Okay, that's useful. Nothing wrong with that. But I prefer to use more psychological criteria. I prefer to ask the question, what reactions in the human heart does beauty produce if it's great? C.S. Lewis wrote a book on that called An Experiment in Criticism. It starts with a question, what is a great book? And he says, traditionally, we have tried to define great reading as something that can be done only with a great book. And obviously, we should read a book in the same spirit that the author wrote it. He's not denying that. But he says, suppose we reverse the equation and say, we can define a great book as anything that is capable of eliciting great reading. And what is great reading? Well, deep appreciation, understanding your humanity, maybe even having something of an out-of-body experience. That's a useful approach, too. I can do a little more of that, and I did in the talk on beauty. beauty is something that brings you closer to God by getting you out of yourself. Beauty is something that appeals to love. Those are psychological criteria. And paradoxically, I think those are more universal and easier to agree on than the objective criteria. Not everybody agrees that beauty has to have harmony. You need disharmony too, at least to set off the harmony. So when you argue about what makes a thing objectively beautiful, it's hard to come to agreement. But strangely, when you ask what makes a thing subjectively beautiful, I think there's much more agreement. I guess these people that like Frank Peretti and Tim LaHaye get something like an out-of-body experience from those trashy books.
Have you seen any beautiful new church architecture?
Yeah. But I'm going to sound like an old fogey here. All the examples I can think of recent church architecture that I consider beautiful are examples that have a very large stake in the past. I was just at the National Cathedral yesterday, and the eastern sort of arch style of the building was very beautiful. It was proportionate, but the art inside I thought was kind of cheap and cartoony. And then I went to the Crypt Church underneath, which was much more traditional, much more old, and I loved it. And I had this strange paradoxical feeling that the ceiling of the crypt, which deliberately exaggerates the lowness, was higher than that incredibly high ceiling up there, higher spiritually. I told this story in a talk I gave this morning. Apologies to those of you who heard it. A Muslim student of mine wanted to go to Mass. I took him to Mass. He said, "I'm not converting to Catholicism or anything. I just want to see what you do when you go to Mass." So I took him to St. Mary's Hall at Boston College, which is a beautiful old stone building where the Jesuits live. But the Mass was the new rite, and the priest was very informal and friendly and whatnot. After Mass, he asked me two questions. He said, "Who made this building? How old is it?" I said, "It's about 150 years old." He said, "And who made the words that the priest was speaking?" I said, "Well, the liturgy itself goes back to the early church, but those actual words were only composed 30 or 40 years ago, and the priest added some of his own." He said, "I thought so." I said, "Why?" I pressed it. He said, "Well, when I look at the stones, my spirit goes up vertically. When I listen to the words, my spirit simply runs along the ground horizontally." I said, "You should become a Catholic. We need you as a liturgist." Good point. Good point. Most of us, though, I'm afraid, take such a practical and lustful attitude towards food that it's very difficult to be a contemplative and to say, "I want to appreciate the beauty of the green in that pea before I eat it." But it's possible. It's a real possibility. And the Chinese can do that because they have so many words for tastes and for smells that don't exist in any Western language. So that's a real contemplative possibility that most people don't explore much. And that would do a lot to overcome the sin of gluttony, to take a more detached and contemplative attitude towards food. Appreciate it, yes, not less, but more, by not going, "Ah, I gotta have it." And that's obviously true of alcohol. The alcoholic does not and cannot appreciate alcohol. Only the gourmet can. One of the passages in the Bible that Muslims hate is the psalm that says, "God invented wine to gladden the heart of man." The word alcohol, by the way, is an Arabic word. It's a spit word. Alcohol! So you can see how they hate it. But if God invented wine to gladden the heart of man, God wants us to drink wine. Now, you can appreciate wine only when you're not drunk. So we've changed gladden to sadden by the third glass. But Thomas Aquinas himself says, cure for depression, a hot bath, a good night's sleep, and one large glass of wine.
I'm sorry, and you mentioned the three different parishes. Just give us a hypothetical example of the ministry of the meeting. What if there were each parish is missing one of them? If you have a parish that's missing truth, can it still be beautiful, or does it cease to be beautiful if it's missing one of the other?
Anything that's totally lacking in truth is also totally lacking in beauty. But the parish I was thinking of was a parish where the church architecture was beautiful, and the hymns were beautiful, but the priest was a heretic, and he was spouting heresy. But those sermons in the stained glass window are utterly orthodox, and a lot of truth coming through them. So the light coming from his mouth was not very great, but the light coming through the windows was still great. So there was truth there.
I think it's kind of interesting that, you know, in our information age, the current most popular enigmatic medical diagnosis is sensory processing disorders, whether it's auditory or all sorts of vestibular things. And I wonder if our information age has overloaded us to the point where we don't have the contemplative time or the quiet, and we're losing our sense of beauty. And I almost wonder if you
Oh, that's a very profound question. I'm glad you said that, because that's an essential point for me to make. We never reach the point where it's too late. You can always say no and retreat into silence. You can always escape the muzak. And without it, you go crazy. You go crazy. You can't appreciate sound without silence. Take words. Most of our words come from other words. And they're not wholly without beauty. They're appropriately linked to other words, but they just, to use my Muslim friend's image, flow along the ground like shallow streams. But some words emerge from the silence, like the words of Jesus. They surprise you. They're like an arrow that comes from nowhere and hits you in the heart. But without silence, you can't bring the words out of silence. Every actor knows that the most eloquent thing he can possibly say is the silences between his sentences. So without silence, a civilization goes crazy.
I think that's where we are.
Yeah. This is why we're turning to Eastern mysticism. They at least give you ways to cultivate silence. But we've got such treasures in our own backyard, why turn there? Now, here is something every single one of us as an individual can do very powerfully to redeem the culture, without entering politics, without signing petitions, without writing books. Just enter into the silence for 15 minutes a day, assuming you already pray. Add purely silent prayer. You'll think you're doing nothing. No, you're not doing nothing. You're doing something very difficult. It takes immense energy to do nothing, to just be there. And it's worth the effort. And once you do that, somehow you plug into a network of silence of other people, even without knowing them. And it's like a disease, but it's a good disease. It spreads. If we could see, if God let us see all the spiritual connections that we don't see, that are invisible. If God let us see, for instance, all the effects of the smallest prayer that we make on all the other people in our culture, and all the effects of those effects on succeeding generations, I don't think we would be able to get up off our knees again for the rest of our lives. We would just overcome with the power and the responsibility. We know that gravity holds the whole universe together. That every single particle of matter in the universe, no matter how far away, has a gravitational attraction to every other particle of matter in the universe, which can be precisely measured mathematically, even when you can't see it. Why should less be true of spirit? If I purify my own soul, I've purified your soul too, because we're all in this body together. You're a cell in the same body that I'm a cell in. And if I harm me, I harm you. There's no victimless crimes. There's no private sins. We always sin against our brother.
Great. You said in your talk that music is a special power. Can I talk
that ecstasy.
Yeah.
Maybe I should position myself in that. I think there's a lot of truth to that. But I was wondering what it was that you thought it was about music that gives it that special power.
I don't know directly, but indirectly, it transcends words. It's inherently mystical. It's the art you can't explain in words. You can translate other arts a little bit into other media, but to put music into words, can't do it. Most historians think that music, nobody can prove this because it's going back thousands and thousands of years. Music, by the way, is present in every single culture that we know of, no matter how primitive. And most anthropologists think that music evolved rather late, that the original language was purely pragmatic, like grunts and groans, meaning, I hurt, please help me. And then came something like the first writing, which many of them say was uniform numbers for the purpose of commerce, two bulls for four goats. And then came articulate sentences, like, I like the sky, do you like it too? And then came the elaboration of that in poetic language. Roses are red, violets are blue. And then came music on top of the poetic languages. Some philosophers, though, and some people like Tolkien and C.S. Lewis, think it's the other way around. Music came first. The language in which God created the world was music. The language Adam and Eve spoke in the Garden of Eden before the Tower of Babel was music. And then it degenerated into poetry, and then it degenerated into prose, and then it degenerated into mathematics, and then into grunts and groans. At least symbolically, I prefer that anthropology.
You spoke of beauty as being something that is, in a way, simply seen. It seems like some people are much naturally more gifted in perceived beauty than others. Are there certain things that we can do as individuals to enhance our perception of beauty?
Same thing we can do as individuals to become more saintly. You just do it. How do you get to Carnegie Hall? You know the joke. Practice, man, practice. There's not, to my knowledge, any button you can push to do that. When you get to something as precious as truth, goodness, and beauty, there's nothing more fundamental that can cause them. You just have to want them and love them and enact them, and then they catch, and they're attractive. How, for instance, can you create love? God commands us to love God with our whole heart. Well, we all have divided hearts, and none of us perfectly obey that commandment. So how can we make ourselves love God more? What's the button that we can push in our souls? What's the method? There isn't any. Love is not something that you can create with a method, because a method means causality. You can create light in this room by wiring it for electricity and putting a little button on the wall, and then flipping the switch gives you light. So an easy cause through the catalyst of an electrical wiring system produces a great effect, light. That's what technology does. It makes hard things easy. There's no technology for prayer, for love, for beauty. Why? Because those are too big to produce by pushing buttons. What's bigger than love that can produce it? Nothing. Except union. When you're one with God, you love. But love sort of is like a fountain that whooshes you up into the divine union. And knowing God and praying to God and practicing the presence of God whooshes you up into that love and that intimacy. So his strategy is always to get you into the center of things and up. But it's not a method. It's not like yoga, where if you do these exercises, you will become a saint. I love the sentence from William Law's Serious Call to the Devout Life. He says, if you will consult your own heart in utter honesty, you must come to the conclusion that there is one and only one reason why you are not as saintly as the primitive Christians. You do not wholly want to be. So please want to be.
I'm wondering what you think, as you're speaking about the beauty being a sign that points to heaven. Could you expand on what you think the ugliness of a lot of modern art and modern pop culture? What does that point to?
I'm less confident in defining ugliness even than I am in defining beauty, because I think there's less agreement about it. Beauty is notoriously relative. It's obviously not totally relative. We can talk about it and educate each other in it, but it's certainly much more relative than truth or goodness. But it's still talkaboutable. When I ask about ugliness, I scandalize my Southern Baptist friends by saying that their praise choruses are ugly. Or I scandalize the St. Louis Jesuits by saying Marty Haugen is ugly. I don't want to do that because I'm not sure I'm right. Maybe I'm missing something. I know I'm missing something in modernist art. I know that there's something in Picasso besides a fake, but I don't get it. Yeah, I sort of get it in something like Guernica. That's pretty obvious. But, well, each of us has a temperament, just as each of us has a taste, that prefers some foods to others, that's made for certain foods. William F. Buckley said, everything since Bach has been downhill. That's a bit exaggerated, but I almost agree with him. But I certainly respect the vast majority of people, not just silly people, but wise people who disagree with him. So I'm very reluctant to even try to answer the question, what makes something ugly? Because quite possibly, in what other people see as ugly, you can see as something beautiful. I don't think Andy Warhol's soup cans are beautiful. I think he's just a hack. But certainly, Giacometti's tall walking figure is beautiful. By being ugly, it shows us our own inner emptiness. Took me a long time to appreciate that kind of art, but I think there's something there. So I think our attitude should always be, give them the benefit of the doubt, open your mind and your spirit, your sensibilities, and maybe you will discover some beauty in the previously ugly. If not, just move on. But to trust your immediate reaction to ugliness, I think, is a bad mistake. Trust your immediate reaction to beauty is good. But to say, I don't like that, that's ugly. A lot of people did that with Jesus.
Do you think we respond to beauty to the extent that we respond to grace? Like, here's an example. Like, 20 years ago, I remember when I was in Italy, and I was dying to Catholicism. I mean, it just absolutely bored me. You know, and now,
I would prefer not to put the question in those terms because I think that's too narrow a concept of grace. I love St. Teresa's last words on her deathbed. Everything is a grace. So beauty is one form of grace.
You're saying that Jesus was embracing the cross and bringing the beauty out of the ugliness. So if we want to be Christ-like, then we have to embrace the ugliness and drop forth the beauty. Like, to the pure, all things are pure. So, to be...
There's two different kinds of ugliness. There's dangerous ugliness that you have to be very pure to embrace. A saint could go and evangelize a whorehouse, but not an ordinary Christian. And then there's the ugliness of suffering, which doesn't do your soul any automatic harm, but it does your body a lot of harm, does your feelings a lot of harm. But that's safe. That's physical evil, but it's not moral evil. It's sort of sanitized evil. It's like the difference between death and divorce. Divorce is dirty. Death is not.
You said something about cars attracting and repelling at the same time that you never really explained. Could you explain?
Oh, boy. No. Well, maybe. Obviously, we have divided souls. So one half of our soul is attracted by Christ, by his holiness, by his love, by his unselfishness, by his invitation to martyrdom. The other half of us is afraid and repelled of exactly that. That's with Christ. That's different from what I said before about the ecstasy, where you not only are attracted to it, but you're in such awe of it that you shrink back. You don't shrink back because it's ugly. You shrink back because it's beautiful. That's more like swimming when the tide is turning. And there's one tide going out and another tide coming in, and they're both wonderful, but you're stuck between them.
It seems to experience beauty, you have to have a tremendous or robust capacity at wonder. In our cynical age, with every, we try to reduce everything to a news story or a blog post or a tweet or whatever. And I guess I'm just wondering how we revive that sense of wonder that our age so quickly attempts to assassinate.
Michael Medved has something very good about that. In The Abolition of Childhood, he said, we all have the capacity for wonder because we were all children once, and children naturally wonder. But we grow up so fast, and we even adultize our childhood, that we stultify our wonder. So to get back wonder and the appreciation of beauty, get back childhood. Now, a lot of people are doing that. They're irresponsible. They spend hours and hours before TV games or something. But that shows that they innately feel that they've missed something. I guess we shouldn't encourage childishness, but we should encourage childlikeness. And sometimes the two are so close that maybe the one can lead to the other. So I'm not that worried, as most old people are, that kids are addicted to TV games, because some of them are kind of enchanting, and some of them are not. Again, I have no buttons to push. You've put your finger on a very dread disease, the abolition of wonder and the abolition of childhood. And if there were some gimmicky way of getting it back, well, wonder isn't gimmicky. There can't be a gimmicky way of getting it back.
I spent 20 years, 3 weeks, and 4 days in a Southern Baptist.
You sound like a prisoner who knows exactly how long he's been in jail. And?
Before entering the church, I should say. One of the things that pulled, there were certain forces that pulled me into the church, there was some that drove me out of being a Southern Baptist. And the liturgy, or quasi-liturgy of Southern Baptist, was one of those things. And the rise of liturgical movement and dance, as it's called in these Protestant contexts. I never understood. I didn't understand the beauty of it. Some insisted on the beauty of it. It always perplexed me. It bothered me. And even I didn't want to be sort of like those looking at King David and scoffing at it. Mm-hmm. But you've not mentioned anything about dance as a form of liturgical beauty. Do you find it beautiful? Is it possible?
Don't ask me. I'm a clumsy Dutchman who stepped on his wife's bridal gown during the reception.
Well, I'm not asking if it's beautiful with you,
Dan. Okay. Touché. You know, I find liturgical dance beautiful in other cultures. Yes. Just as I find black spirituals beautiful and moving when black people do it, but not when white people do it. I think that's very culturally relative.
So you talked about the unity of truth, goodness, and beauty. And that makes my, key famous phrase of beauty is truth, good beauty. You know, at first glance that seems good, but it seems satisfying. But then you think about, well, what about those truths that seem a little harder, that don't seem quite so beautiful, like, the truth that, the matter that can be reported, millions and millions of things. How can we say truths like that have anything to do with
it? Good question. I think you go through three stages there. The first is a kind of intuitive, gee, that sounds nice, I like that. Beauty is truth, truth, beauty. Then you ask questions like you do and say, that's nonsense. Not all truth is beautiful. There are ugly truths. And some beauty is fake and fantastic and not beautiful. Then you go to a third stage and say, wait a minute, the admission of truth and the love of truth is itself beautiful, no matter how ugly the truth is. So truth as such is beautiful. And all true beauty is, well, by definition, true. So there is something profound about that, after you go through the rightly skeptical question. The second half of the quotation doesn't make sense, though. That is all you know on earth and all you need to know. No. I like to quote Chesterton. There is one thing that is needful. Everything. The rest is vanity of vanities.
For a virtuous person, what are the different kinds of beauties that, working together, produce the love that leads to marriage?
All of them. Unless you see in your spouse all the human loves and some of every kind of beauty, there's something missing. For instance, suppose you have erotic love but not friendship. It's not going to be a good marriage. Suppose you have friendship but not erotic love. It's not going to be a good marriage. Suppose you see that there's beauty in soul but terrible ugliness in body. You're going to have a problem. Suppose you see beauty in body but ugliness in soul. It's going to be a problem. So I think it all comes together. Just as marriage is the completest of all human relationships, you give your whole self to the other. So the different forms of beauty that should exist there all have to exist. They don't all have to be perfect. None of us are perfect. But it's, once again, everything. The rest is vanity of vanities.
I know from my own life that the person I was
I thought I did. Ask me a specific question about that. It's powerful. Yeah. Gregorian chant did it to me too. I had never heard it before. By the way, Gregorian chant is now immensely popular among non-Catholics. Catholics still don't like it that much. Go figure. The theology of the body is making leaps and bounds among Protestants, almost more than among Catholics. The pro-life movement is making more gains among Protestants than among Catholics. The realization that contraception is unnatural is making immense gains among Protestants, more so than among Catholics. What's happening? Well, God's shaking us up. Who knows what's going to come out of the shaking? But you're right. All those things are selling points.
The woman over here, very perceptively pointed out the proliferation of images in our culture. And is there a special problem that we face because man has become the object of science? And I think about the evolution of man, that problem. Is there something special about this?
Those are two problems. I don't see the relation between them. But the fact that we're an image culture means we can be manipulated much more than if we're a verbal culture. Somebody gives you an argument. You have a little man sitting at the gate of your castle, and it's called reason, and he doesn't have to let that argument in if he finds it illogical. But if somebody gives you an image, let's say a pornographic image, it itself, without your will, is in your mind and harms you. Images creep in under the gate like water seeping under the castle wall. Good ones as well as bad ones. That's why images are so powerful. I guess that can be a destructive means to the abolition of your humanity. But the scientific reduction of man to an object and the refusal to respect man as a subject and an intrinsically valuable person, that's even more destructive because that's deliberate. And that is a force in our society. Despite the fact that we're moving down the garbage heap into Brave New World, there's all sorts of hope and signs that we're recognizing this. In That Hideous Strength, Lewis comes up with this beautiful little summary of human history. The bad are getting worse and the good are getting better. I think that's a perceptive summary of the last 200 years. One more question. I should, before the last question, make two announcements. My webmaster says I should advertise petercrafe.com. I'm allergic to technology, but I've got all my books and stuff on that. And secondly, I'm a ping pong player, so anybody who wants a game afterwards is invited upstairs. Last question. I want to take a side on that.
You do?
I do.
Yeah, I would appreciate your
answer. I think it is very right to do that. And I think you have to be a Canadian to disagree with me. They're so polite. They say to their government, of course you're going to abuse us. That's okay. We want to be polite. No, what is wrong with exposing people to the truth? Suppose you were allowed to show the horrors in Auschwitz to the average German citizen. No, it might have toppled Hitler earlier. If something horrible is happening, covering it up is more horrible. The only thing necessary for the triumph of evil is that the good do nothing, especially reveal the evil. Now, that's probably going to be illegal. You'll probably be thrown in jail. During the 1992 Democratic Convention in New York City, a pro-life activist, well outside the 10-foot limit, stood by the convention hall when President Clinton came in, and he had an image of a large aborted fetus. It was perfectly legal. He was thrown in jail. And none of the TV cameras saw that incident or filmed that incident. Well, if 100 people did that, the TV cameras would have to film it. If 100 bishops marched with those pictures and got thrown in jail, the newspapers would have to headline 100 bishops thrown in jail. That would be wonderful. Not because I hate bishops, but because I love them. There's a story of a holy bishop who commissioned a young theologian in his diocese to study what factors caused people to go into the priesthood. They wanted to increase vocations. And he wrote a learned sociological study, which he presented it to his bishop. And the last paragraph was, but the single most important cause of an increase in vocations in this diocese, Your Excellency, would be your own canonization. That was not an insult. The bishop rewarded him for that. So please be a saint.